Hey everyone, welcome to the NFL Roadshow with Lindsay Rhodes and the offseason that will not quit. This has been nuts. Just day after day of jaw-dropping news that I swear to God gets wilder as the days go on. Tyreek Hill, the latest big move as of now. I'm probably dating this entire episode just by saying that. Took about an hour and a half on Wednesday for the news to go from Chiefs open to trading him to Chiefs have traded him. And it's huge, obviously, for Kansas City, for the AFC West, for the Dolphins who got him. And I gotta say, I've been looking at their roster and I think I may have underestimated Miami a bit in my initial consideration of this deal. They've made a lot of moves this offseason to put themselves in a pretty nice position to be competitive next year. Let's look at their offense. So they obviously have Tua at quarterback with Teddy behind him. Okay, we'll get back to that. But then at wide receiver, they have Tyreek. They have Jalen Waddle, who Dolphins wide receiver coach Wes Welker just compared to Tyreek 4 weeks ago with a 4.3 40 time. He's super fast. Cedric Wilson, also brought in this offseason. They've got Gesicki and Durham Smythe at tight end. At running back, they've got Chase Edmonds, Raheem Mostert, also a 4.3 40 guy, Miles Gaskin. And then huge, 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 they brought in Teron Armstead on the line to play tackle. Plus, they got Connor Williams to play guard and Mike McDaniels, who I think I love. Are they going to be good next year? What is happening? Anyway, they appear to be much better than they were a couple of weeks ago. Will definitely be a make or break year for Tua. This is the team to put around him. We're going to know one way or another whether he is the right guy. So there's added benefit there to making these moves. Also worth mentioning, they not only brought in Hill, but they kept him out of New York, which was the other team that was in it at the deadline for this deal, the Jets. And there's added benefit there too, especially since the reports are that New York's offer, which was being considered, did not involve either of their top 10 picks. They were going to do this deal for a couple of high twos instead of the low one and low two that the Dolphins ended up giving away, which would have meant that the Jets would have picked up Hill and still had two picks in the top 10. So from a football standpoint, all of this is just a massive game changer for Miami. I do want to say, since we just talked about Watson last week on the pod, in the way that we did, I feel like I need to acknowledge, not a huge fan of Hill either, right? I remember talking to people when that voicemail came out. It feels like decades ago now, but anyway, several years ago, that voicemail that came out of him threatening his son's mom, the way that he talked to her, I remember thinking, this is too damaging for him to come back from. He sounds like none of this is good. Quickly learned that a little bit more cynicism was required on my part. So personally, he's not a guy I draft in fantasy football, but he is in the league. I got to talk about him. He's quite clearly a good football player, so this would appear to make the Dolphins better. I do think it's interesting, as he resets the wide receiver market that Adams just reset a week ago, that we have these wide receivers just blowing previous financial highs out of the water at the exact same time that their longtime teams are passing on the opportunity to do that for them. And I wonder what that means. I'm not sure I have the answer, but I do think it's interesting because there's a reason that we're all shocked that Green Bay and Kansas City allowed those guys to leave. You don't usually see that. Is it tied to those teams having so much money invested in the quarterback position that they can't pay a top of market wideout and still be competitive? Is it that they think there's a tipping point in terms of return on investment for the wide receiver? I feel like that's something I'm going to want to look into further. And certainly it helped both teams make these deals knowing that it was a good wide receiver class this year in the draft. And now the Packers and the Chiefs are going to no doubt go in that direction in the first round. I will say this, though, about their first round picks. They might not be high enough to get the guy that they want. They might have to move. Good news for both teams. They have multiple first round picks. As I said, Packers with 22 and 28, Chiefs with 29 and 30. Is that going to be enough to get a guy capable of coming in and replacing the production that they're losing? Because it's one thing to get a good wide receiver that you can just put opposite another good wide receiver. It's another thing entirely to go get a one, an alpha, a star, a Ja'Marr Chase. Vikings did it with Justin Jefferson. They got him at 22 the year he came out, 2020. He was the fifth wideout off the board that year after, by the way, Ruggs, Judy, Lamb, and Rager. So Lamb is good. I don't know that I know about Judy yet. I mean, he's good, but is he that good? I don't know yet. We'll find out this year, I think, with Russell Wilson. Ruggs, who knows, right? That situation's so specific, but I certainly don't think he was shaping up to be a guy you'd be comfortable swapping Adams or Hill for. Obviously, same for Rager. Chase last year, that one works. He's on their level. What about the other first rounders? We mentioned Waddle. He's in a good spot. Devontae Smith, Kadarius Toney, Rashad Bateman. I don't know. We'll see. Of course, it doesn't have to end up being a one-to-one talent comparison. They did get other assets in the deals to make up for that drop-off. You just have to be good enough so there isn't some crazy drop-off in production, right? What this does, though, I think, is put a lot of pressure on both of those front offices to nail that draft pick, which is not a given, even in a class that is deep, as this wide receiver class is. Because the point is winning. We can understand not wanting to pay a guy top of market, but you better have a plan B that helps you win, because that's the point. And very few people change the geometry of the field the way that Hill does, specifically. And very few people know that, as well as my guest today, who has spent 30 plus years in and around NFL front offices as a scout, as a pro personnel director, and most recently as the general manager for the Minnesota Vikings for the last 10 years. You know Rick Spielman as the guy responsible for drafting Justin Jefferson and Adrian Peterson, for trading for Jared Allen, and also for bringing in and paying Kirk Cousins. He's made so many trades and free agency moves and draft picks, and is deeply familiar with the process surrounding those things. And he has a specific process, as I learned. And I very much enjoyed talking to him about that. So without further ado, a free agent himself, Rick Spielman. Let's break the huddle.
Hurry up, let's go!
Two on two on two, ready? Three.
Rick, I want to start with how many times, and maybe this is my proximity to him and it's just the way that I specifically see it, but I can't be the only one that thinks that you look very, very similar to Scott Hansen. Do you get that a lot?
Yes, I did get that a lot, except I think Scott lost his glasses. So yeah, I think he got LASIK, if I believe. So yeah, no, but there has been people that have compared us as long lost brothers.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you already have a famous brother. You might as well have another one.
Yeah,
I suppose. I don't know how much you've had a chance to see Scott Hansen do his thing, because I know Sundays are a very busy time for you. This time of year, usually very busy for you as well. How are you experiencing this offseason?
It's been interesting to take a step back and watch how everybody is operating. And I think all the, from a fan perspective, the excitement, all the big moves that, you started to see that trend a little bit last year when the Rams traded for Stafford. And then, all the trades and the free agency moves this year, there's been a lot of high price, a lot of all pro type talent that has changed teams. So that's been kind of interesting to see how much more aggressive the offseason is getting with teams moving players.
Does it feel like more than usual? It does to me.
It does. And I think it's happened quick. I mean, last year, I can't remember everything, but I know the biggest headliner was when Detroit and the Rams made the Matthew Stafford trade. But then you look at every day, it seems like something else is big. I mean, as soon as Aaron Rodgers was extended, 2 hours later, Russell Wilson is in Denver, and then, the Chargers are trading for Khalil Mack. Because they need to get a pass rusher. It's been funny just watching the AFC West. It's like watching a heavyweight fight. because every other day through these first 14 or 15 days of free agency, it seems like punch, counterpunch. I got this guy. Well, I'm going to go get this guy. And it's been really, fun to watch. And I'm sure it's fun to watch from a fan perspective.
That division in particular feels like it's just been one big game of one-upmanship. Like we're, continually moving teams. They're jumping. This one goes down to three. They're up in one, for a minute. And then another team makes a move and we have to reorder the whole division. How do you see them right now competitively?
It's going to be maybe the most competitive division. Now, that's not taken into account that there's injuries or anything like that. But you look at the quarterbacks in that division, you look at all the moves that have been made this offseason. But, only one team's going to be able to win that division. And everybody's, going after Kansas City because they've been kind of the king of the hill for a while in that division. So you've seen all these teams get aggressive as they have gotten. But at the end, one team's going to win it. And then, are the other three that didn't win the division going to be disappointed, even though they were so aggressive and made some very, very, very good moves in the offseason to help improve their rosters?
Seems hard to imagine that division won't send three to the playoffs this year. But even if they do, it's like, which is the one that's left out? For me, I might be alone in this. I think that could very well be the Broncos, even though they just made this big Russell Wilson move. How impactful do you see the Russell Wilson addition to Denver in terms of elevating that team and their chances to be competitive?
Well, yeah, there's a couple things there. And I talked a little bit about it yesterday on some of the hits that I did. But the Russell Wilson trade with the Denver Broncos was very unique. And one, they were able to swing and get and trade for a potential Hall of Fame quarterback. I know at the time, everybody looked like it cost them a lot of draft picks. It cost them some players. But if you look at the players that left, there was I think it was Shelby that was a 30-year-old defensive tackle. And the other two young guys were coming out of their contract. They only had 1 year remaining on their contract. They used the draft capital from the Von Miller trade as part of the deal too. So when they traded Von Miller during a season, they were able to help build up the draft capital to go get a Russell Wilson. The other thing too is they still have 9 draft picks. And I know George Payton very well. We've worked together for plus 20 some years. So I know they do a great job. They have a great staff, new coaching staff, putting together that roster, and they're still going to be able to fill a lot of needs through the draft. The other thing that I think people may have talked about or not talked about was that organization and that club is up for sale. So when you're able to go out and land a Russell Wilson in a trade and whatever billions that franchise is going to cost, does that franchise value increase now because you have a Russell Wilson as your quarterback? So I think those are all the things that, and if you look back at, let's say that trade made the value of that organization $200, $300, $400, $500 million more. When you look back,
is that
back
possible?
That's possible. I believe it's possible. So, but I've talked to some people out there, and they think the value of that could be worth over $500 million when that club gets. So, if you look at it from that perspective, that's a heck of a deal and a heck of a trade that they made. Not only they got a future Hall of Fame quarterback, but look at how they increased the value of that franchise.
On Seattle's side, trying to figure out what they're doing. And they were very quick to point the finger as soon as they were able to announce the move officially saying, Russell wanted out, Russell wanted out, Russell wanted out. It was very much like he did it, not us, don't blame us. But in terms of where they go from here and why they would make the move, even if Russell wanted it, I haven't quite figured out how to read the tea leaves there, because they're talking about Drew, like, yeah, we really like him and he might be the guy, but then also they want Geno back and he'd be out in front of the competition at this point if he did come back. And that tells me they don't like Drew that much. So what do you see there?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I thought was the whatever the GIFs or whatever they're called. I'm still learning social media when they had Pete Carroll yelling in the water, Wilson! Tom Hanks, whatever that movie.
Castaway.
Yeah, Castaway. So very, very inventive. I thought that was the best thing of the trade, to be honest with you. I'm just kidding.
It was good.
I think that Seattle has a plan. I know the people in the front office there very well, and I know they're going to be looking at that quarterback position. Now, as a GM or as an organization, after you bring in these players, you're sure not going to say that, hey, well, this guy can't play. Okay. Right. That's your job to build them up. It's job to encourage the talent that you're bringing in, because you don't want your fan base, well, geez, we don't have a chance this year. But there's still a lot of time left between now and I believe the opening game. I think there's a couple months ahead of us yet before all these moves get finalized and the roster gets finalized. I would imagine they're looking very strongly at some of these quarterbacks in the draft. Everybody is kind of dinging them right now on this is not a strong draft class, but someone's going to surface out of there. You know, when you look back, and I don't know if everybody really could have predicted that Patrick Mahomes was going to be who Patrick Mahomes was. You know, some of the, draft experts out there maybe thought he was a second round value at best. But I know with the teams and all the research that's going on right now, that one of these guys are going to potentially rise up and be a next franchise type quarterback for somebody. Which one? That's what everybody's trying to determine right now. The other thing you have going on is there's musical chairs of quarterback in the NFL keep going around and around. There's Garoppolo yet, and there's Baker Mayfield. So where do those guys end up landing? And is Seattle looking at one of those two to potentially come in as well?
Does one of those two seem to fit better there?
I think it's what they envision on what their offense is going to be. I know they.
Well, we know with Pete, it's going to be they're going to run.
Right. Well, if you look at what San Francisco did last year with Garoppolo, they were a very good run team, setting up the play action pass, giving him an opportunity to make plays off the run RPOs and moving the ball up and down that way. So is that Seattle going to try to emulate what San Fran did? But also I know, you know, the Cleveland Browns and Kevin Stefanski was our offensive coordinator. And I was with him for over 12 years in the Minnesota Vikings. And they were kind of a run-based team with the two running backs that they had with Chubb and Hunt, and then built off that play action and throw the ball. So if that is the direction that Seattle's going, you know, because Seattle in the past has been three wise, they've been letting Russell cook, as they used to say, as the media, I guess, termed it. But it'll be interesting to see if their philosophy is going to be like a Cleveland or like a San Francisco. Is Garoppolo or Baker Mayfield a better option? But you also know that Garoppolo is coming off that shoulder surgery. And when is he going to be ready? How significant was that surgery, especially if it's on his throwing arm? And that'll
have Baker, to be, though, right? Although he had it sooner.
Right. But they're both, let's say they're both. So which one's healthier? Maybe that's potentially what it comes down to.
You mentioned the draft and how a lot of the, you know, draft experts were wrong about Mahomes, have been. It's a hard position to predict.
Not only draft experts, there are a lot of people wrong about Mahomes. So let's not just put it on the draft experts.
That's what I was actually going to say. There were a lot of front offices that were wrong, or, you know, maybe would have taken him sooner in the draft. What have you learned over the years about how to, in your opinion, isolate the things that matter coming out of college with regard to the quarterback position, trying to predict what's going to work in the NFL?
Yeah, we really try to continue to evolve and find the answer to this mysterious question on how you identify it, because there, the physical part has to be there. And, you know, and you look at, I remember back when was it Jamarcus Russell and Matt Ryan came out. And I went back to back to both their workouts. And if you looked at the two workouts and the physical and the way they threw the ball, it wasn't even comparable. Russell was a lot better than Matt Ryan was, but Matt Ryan had a much better career, went to the Super Bowl and has been to the Pro Bowl. So we delved down into what are things besides the physical traits that you can identify to try to minimize the risk when you select a position that's of major need in this league. So we dealt, you know, I always thought that one of the things that were critical was intelligence. And so doing a bunch of intelligence tests, what I've learned from some of the mistakes that I made, it's not only the intelligence part, but it's the mental quickness. Because I've had quarterbacks and we've sat in interviews and they can go up there and draw cover two on the board. They can draw this adjustment, that adjustment, and they're sound like an offensive coordinator. And that's in a 20, 25 minute session, interview session. But can they do that same thing when you got four or five or six, seven guys coming to take your head off? And can you process that same thing that you explained on the board in less than 2.5 seconds? And so that's the difference that I learned between the intelligence and how quickly they can process and how quickly they can get through their progressions. And you don't always see that in college because I don't know, depending on the school, how many times they have to go through a progression like an NFL quarterback does. A lot of it, it's a quick snap the ball. It's basketball on grass, throw to this target, throw to that target, and get the ball out of your hands. So there's a big adjustment coming up to our league. But those are the things and some of the things that I think I learned from it. It's not only the intelligence, but how quickly they can process. And we went and delved deep into some analytics and some different types of cognitive testing and other tests to try to see if we can identify that.
What do you mean cognitive testing? How would that play out?
I think it all ties into everything. I mean, that position, because not only the stress that they're getting on the field and they're the ones that are touching the ball every snap, you know, on offense predominantly, unless you're running a wildcat or something, but not to digress here.
Who is these days though?
But those are the guys that have the biggest influence on the game. So any type of testing that you can do that can measure up in here and even in here, that seems to be where you can hopefully get the answer to the difference between someone's physical ability, but are they able to go out on the field and perform and then handle the outside scrutiny that's coming at him every week?
The quarterback, obviously, you know, if you have one, then you have a chance. If you don't, then you don't. That's obviously one of the biggest problems, I guess, that general managers in the league face right now is looking for that right guy and then trying to hold on to that guy.
Right. I think it's evolved a little bit. You know, because when you looked at what a Brad Johnson or a Joe Flacco were actually able to win Super Bowls, but they all had very good defensive. They had a strong running game. But it seems like, especially this year, when you watch the playoffs, I mean, the quarterback position, especially in the AFC, took over. I mean, you saw Mahomes versus Allen. You saw all these young guns.
Burrow without a line.
Yeah. And if they don't have Joe Burrow, are they playing in the Super Bowl this year? So that is where I think it's even becoming more evident that you need a quarterback to win in this league, the way the game has evolved. You know, back when I first started and even through most of my career, the coaches that I've been with, it's always been, we're going to play, you know, defense. We're going to be top 10 defense in the league. We're going to run the ball, and then we're going to try to create plays off the running game. But I think what you're seeing and way the game is evolving now, that it's changed tremendously. And that's why you see all this quarterback movement and all these trades.
Yeah. It's funny. We just talked about Seattle. It feels like Pete Carroll is one of the lone holdouts in that regard. Like, it seems like he's still talking about the team, like defense and the running game. And that's the way that he thinks that they can still win.
Yeah. Take anything away from what San Francisco did last year, because they got as far as they got.
True.
Because they played great defense and they ran the ball. And what team ever won a playoff game in Green Bay and didn't score an offensive touchdown and still end up winning the game? So there is, you don't want to take away. You still have to play good defense. I mean, Buffalo going into the Kansas City game, I believe, was one of the top rated, or if not the top rated defense. So you can't take away. You have to be able to play defense, and you still have to be able to run the ball, especially if you're playing in outdoor weather.
Completely.
And by running the ball, you're also going to control the clock and time of possession. And the game that really stuck out to me the most was San Francisco at Dallas. And in the fourth quarter, how you saw San Francisco control that clock was, and I thought Kyle Shanahan did a phenomenal job with his game management. They were running the ball, they were keeping the clock moving, but they didn't snap the ball to under 5 seconds on the play clock. So that was eating up a lot of time. And if they were snapping the ball at 15, 20 seconds, that may gave extra time for Dallas to come back that game. I know Garoppolo threw the interception, and that kind of gave Dallas some life. But because they were able to run the ball and control the clock in the fourth quarter, that helped them win that playoff game in Dallas, who had a very good football team.
Yeah, no doubt. I think it helps if you have an elite quarterback who can make up for deficiencies around him. Barring that, you have to have a good enough quarterback that can execute the things that you need him to do. San Francisco, perfect example of that, as you mentioned. I think that that's the trickiest thing for teams that are unable to find that elite quarterback that you can plug in and go, that's our guy. It's so obvious that that's our guy, because you have to. I have said for a while that it feels like it's almost better or easier to, you either have a very good quarterback or you have a bad quarterback that you know is not the answer. It almost feels like that's an easier position to be in, because you know to turn the page and go on to the next. But when you have one that is good enough, that's the trickiest part, because you end up, and I think you know something about this, having to pay that quarterback. And then you're in this weird kind of financial situation where, do you have the money left over to put the pieces around that person? But you have to have that quarterback that's good enough. It's hard to move on from a quarterback that is good enough, that is not that elite quarterback.
If you do, what's your answer?
Right.
And then how far are you going to set your franchise back, especially if you have a roster that has some pretty good football players on it that are going to give you a chance to win on game day?
But do you think it's still the right answer to pay that quarterback? Because you have to, because that's what the market says. And if you need to hold on to that quarterback that's more in that middle tier, those are my words, not yours, the good enough quarterback, but not elite quarterback, I think that that's one of the trickiest things that NFL teams, from where I sit, are facing right now, is how you value that guy in a way where you can still build a successful team around him.
Right. And that's it doesn't mean that those guys don't have the potential of winning a Super Bowl. And I go back to our, I believe it was 2017 season, where Case Keenum, played his probably best season of his career. And, Sam Bradford got hurt and he was able to guide us all the way to the NFC championship game. Well, Philadelphia had caught fire towards the end. Carson Wentz had gotten hurt. All of a sudden, Nick Foles comes in, and then he catches fire during the playoffs. And I don't know if you would consider him one of the elite quarterbacks, but he was able to win games, get into the Super Bowl, and end up beating New England in the Super Bowl. So I understand all that from the quarterback standpoint, and not going to argue with you one way or another, but there are other stars that have to align. And you have to get hot at the right time. You have to stay healthy. And that's where some of the other things that we just previously talked about, the defense and the running game, come into play. But I think that was probably the last quarterback, I believe, that won a Super Bowl that you may not consider in the Patrick Mahomes or the Tom Brady's of the world.
How do you build a team around that type of quarterback to still be successful? It's one thing if you're doing it like on a rookie deal, you know, and we're seeing that this offseason. When you've got Justin Herbert and you know you've got one of those top tier guys going into year three, you can spend in free agency and you can put guys around him. The time is now. When you're paying somebody on a second or third contract that is a quarterback, that might not be a Patrick Mahomes, what have you learned about how to build the roster around that person in the best way?
Yeah, you have to identify where you're going to put your other financial commitments. So is that a pass rusher? Is that left tackle? Is that receiver? And you have to really identify, okay, the rest of our resources are going to go to these positions. And we've always looked at it like what positions we used to call blue players were like Pro Bowl or elite type players. Red players were starters you could win with for 16 games. And then down the line. But we tried to identify, take the names out. Where do you want your blues and your reds? And then, okay, so we need an elite pass rusher. Okay, so that's a blue player. So we need to make sure we're going to allocate some resources to there. You could only allocate so much. I mean, especially if where these quarterbacks are going now, you know, in the 50 plus range, how are you going to allocate the rest of that money? So identify that, but the coaches and the front office and the owners got to understand that the rest of it's going to have to come with rookies, with potentially minimum. We can't have a roster of 10 million guys across the board. It's impossible to have to work with the cap. So we really try to hone in. I think most teams try to hone in on what positions do you need the blues to help you get a chance to win a Super Bowl. And that's where we're going to put our resources. And then we're going to have to fill in with the Reds and maybe even a couple of backups, because I did a study a couple of years ago and most of the Super Bowl teams that have won have had four blue players on each side. The rest were Reds, but they were able to hide two lower level players that were starters. And Matt, I don't want to say mass, but just still be successful because they identified that position, we can still win games without having a red or blue player there.
Is that a positional value thing? Is it different for everybody or is it like,
going to be different for everybody, you know? And it depends on the philosophy of the coach. And, you know, part of the interview process when you're interviewing coaches is you're going to ask them, if you are putting your roster together, where do you want to allocate your resources? You know, it's, and you don't have, okay, I say I want 22 blues on the field. Well, that ain't going to happen. But where you can get value is, let's say you spent money on a blue pass rusher, or you spent money on traded for Davante Adams, a blue receiver. Okay, well, then you're really going to have to rely on the draft, and because that's going to be great value, especially if those players become blue. And just to give you an example of one of the things that we saw was that we hit on Justin Jefferson, who's a blue level player, but we're not paying him blue level money yet, and that's coming for him.
Yeah. That's the tricky thing about drafts too. And it's funny, so when you're talking there, it brought to mind Davante Adams and that deal, which I love the deal for the Raiders and Raider fans, because at the very least you're like, we're in it. You just brought in the best, arguably the best wide receiver in the league. And that unlocks Derek Carr and it makes him better and all of these different things. But I also, my brain also goes to Atlanta to a degree, right? You're putting a lot of money into your quarterback. I assume that they're going to extend Carr, and then Davante Adams and the positional value of wide receiver, which we know is one that you want to value, that's correlated to the success of your offense and therefore wins. But, financially, there are people that argue that they're paying him too much. Will they have to pay the piper for this move?
Yeah, that was a record-breaking contract for a receiver by far. But it seems like every year the market is getting reset. You know, back when we signed Kirk Cousins, when we did the contract with him, I think the value of that was maybe 30, 35 million, I think is where the average was, or a little bit below that. But look at where the market is on all these quarterbacks. It's plus 50. So every year, because the cap's going to continue to go up, that the market for these players are going to continue to go up, and the money for the players are going to get continue to go up. The only setback that made it very difficult was when you went through the COVID year and everybody had put these contracts in place previously. All of a sudden they came out and say, bam, you know, the salary cap is going to be 185 now. Well, what are we supposed to do? We just, these are all contracts that are already on our books before we knew that COVID was going to hit. So you had to really, and most teams had to really scramble to make those adjustments. And then it's always how much are you going to push out to the future years too? And teams have to cap plan 2 or 3 years out, because eventually if you keep pushing it out, you're going to have to pay that credit card bill at some point.
Do you? Because I feel like a lot of people thought that credit card bill was coming due for the Saints this year. And then move. We have money. So how real is the cap for someone in your position? And is there always a chance to move it around still?
There's always a chance to move it around, because the cap is basically an accounting exercise. Okay, you have to be at this number. Where the difference becomes is what teams are spending on cash. So some teams say, well, let's say the cap is $10 this year. The owner says, we can only spend $10. So however how you want to allocate those $10 to the team, you can do whatever you want. Some owners are way more aggressive that will say, push it out. Okay, I know the cap is $10 this year, but you have $20 of cash to spend, and just prorate it out and do roster bonuses or do whatever.
Put this one on a credit card.
Put this one on a credit card and we'll figure it out 2 years from now. So, but I think teams are betting on too with all the new potential TV contract, media contracts, Amazon, all that stuff that is coming in, that I think you're going to see a pretty significant bump. Because when we planned for the cap, we were trying to estimate, well, okay, it'll probably go up $8 million this year. So we kind of were able, and that's, you know, what our cap guy would do is kind of give us an estimation of where he thinks it, so we can kind of plan. We always tried to be conservative, but we knew it was going to go up a certain percentage. And so I'm sure teams are looking at that too, and looking at the potential new revenue coming into the NFL, and how much the cap's going to potentially jump down here in the next couple of years.
You said earlier that this offseason had been interesting for you in the sense that you could take a step back and kind of experience the whole thing differently. In what way are you, what are you noticing that maybe you wouldn't have noticed if you were caught up in the minutia of the specific moves that you need to make for your team? And now that you're able to stand back and look at like a big picture of how it's all happening.
You just get more of a global view, because when you're with a team, all you're honed in is you have your blinders on. What do we have to do? What do we need to do? Okay, we put together a master plan on how we're going to attack our needs in free agency. Are there any potential trades out there that we want to do to help attack our needs? How strong is the draft? At what positions they're strong? And try to divide it up in these different buckets and come up with, it almost looks like what I put together was like a call sheet. Like you see the coaches holding on a sideline. Here's our roster. Here's how we graded them. Here's the UFA. Here's the potential cut and trades that are going to happen. And here's the draft. And you place all the players as you graded them in their certain areas. So if you look at offensive guard, for example, okay, here's where we graded our guys. It's not a very deep class in free agency, but boy, there's maybe 5 or 6 options that we're going to be able to see in the draft. So let's hold. I know that's a need, and probably the fans are going to be all over us because we didn't fill it the first 2 days of free agency. But if you stay patient, we'll be able to fill that need during the draft. So you just have to be patient, and you just have to kind of block out the noise. That's what you're doing. And you're just honing in on the plan that you put together in place with your ownership and your coaches and all your personnel people.
In a perfect world, are you also factoring in positional value there? Like, what would we prefer to pay a top of the market free agency price for, and what would we prefer to get on a 5-year rookie deal?
Yeah, I think you have to go into where the depth is. So I remember we signed Tomlinson from the Giants. Okay, that was last year, I believe. But I also knew that it wasn't a very strong defensive tackle draft class last year. So if you want to fill this need, then we're going to have to go free agency, and we're going to have to allocate resources towards signing him. But then it was when we traded for Stephon Diggs, we didn't go fill it in free agency. Like I said, we felt that there was a pretty deep class of receivers, and we were able to fortunately land a Justin. So we filled that need through the draft. So as you're roster planning through your offseason, you're putting a plan in place on this is how we're going to have to fill this need. I remember earlier when I was in Minnesota, we wanted to fill a pass rusher, and we didn't feel very strongly about the UFA market. We didn't feel very strongly about the draft, and we ended up going and trading for Jared Allen. And that came, so we filled that need through that bucket. So in every year that bucket changes.
Yeah. Speaking of the draft, you ran what, 15 drafts in Minnesota?
16.
Yeah. How should is this your favorite time of year, first of all?
I can tell you this. I think most general managers
is the
part they love the most.
Yeah.
It can be very aggravating during free agency because you do not control it. I mean, and you've seen guys that, okay, I committed here, but then I flipped and went here. You can't control. There's not as much control in that. And you
got to recruit.
You have to recruit. You have to pay. You have to figure out how you're going to get the money. But once you get to this point and the pro days are ending, and now you go locked down in April, you know, no one's going to bother you for the whole month of April. And you're just in that room, and you know that you're getting prepared for the draft, and you're going through your meetings, you're meeting with your coaches, you're meeting with your ownership group. But the one thing, big difference that I think every general manager loves is you control what happens on draft day, not the other way around.
To a degree, because you are yes, you're still being reactionary, right? Based on
correct.
What's happening in front of you, but you've planned for that, correct?
Right. That's all planned. So if player A gets taken, what's our next options, B and C? Hey, you know, there's only one running back left. I remember when we drafted Dalvin Cook, okay, in the second round. I think him and Joe Mixon had just went so we moved up to go get Cook because we thought that was the last of the elite running backs. Mm-hmm. But you can control that movement, or at least, you know, and hopefully a team's going to be willing to trade with you. But that's why you see a lot of trades on draft day, because teams are willing to manipulate. You know, everybody's board is probably very similar in the first couple of rounds, but after that, that board really varies from team to team. And that's where you see a lot of the movement and a lot of the trades happen. But you have the ability to hopefully, you know, a lot more ability to control that than you do anything else.
And you're putting those players into tiers, it sounds like, right? Like when you say Dalvin Cook's the last one, like this is the last one in that tier that we really want. So we got to go get him.
Right. We never, we always worked in a tier system. So we tried to identify our, you know, not rounds as much as, okay, is this guy going to be a blue type player? Is this guy going to be a red type player? Is this guy a player that may be able to start 5 or 6 games, but would struggle versus the red and blues if he had to start all 16? So yeah, we had about 8 different tiers as we evolved and what we called weaved the board together. That's how we did it.
How should we determine whether a draft is a success? If you hit in the later rounds, does that make up for whiffs in the early rounds?
Yeah, but I guess what do you consider a success in the later rounds? Is it a guy, let's say he's a really good special team player.
That's a good
and
point.
He's helping you win games that way, and you got him in a 6th or 7th round. Well, is that a success or a failure because he's not starting? You know, I think people tend to think that, okay, unless you're nailing starters in a sixth and seventh round, everything else is a failure. Or what if it's a guy that's a great backup in a rotation on the defensive line that gives you some chance to win games in that particular role? There's a reason why they're down there. And then every once in a while, you're going to get, you know, lucky that they are better than where they went, but they're there for a reason. And we were pretty fortunate on, you know, on hitting a Stephon Diggs in a fifth round or an Adam Thielen as a college free agent. You know, Danielle Hunter, we were able to get in the third round. So I guess if you get enough opportunities, you're going to be able to hit on some of those guys that become reds and blues. But, you know, you have to determine if I've got a guy that's a really good special team player, that he's a solid backup, that if our main guy gets hurt, and I've got him picked him in a sixth or seventh round, I consider that to be a good football player for us, because in his role, he's helping us win games.
Do you think that when people talk about drafts and whether they were successful or not, that oftentimes we're wrong on the outside?
I think because they don't know everything, you know, they'll determine it by, you know, when are you measuring that? It's
well, honestly, most people are saying, did the first rounder hit?
Right.
Right. Like it goes about measured. That deep.
Yeah. But what, and I'm going to ask you this question. Mm-hmm. What, if you're hit, what percentage of first rounders are hits?
Right.
Is it 40%? Is it 50%? Is it 60%?
I'm going to say, do you know an answer? Okay.
Yes,
I'm going to say it's around, I think it's closer to 40.
It's a little higher than that.
Is it?
It's almost 50-50. I won't give you the, I don't have the exact number.
Okay. And, but roughly 50.
Yeah. Let's say roughly 50% if you're the first rounders end up hitting.
Okay. What's a hit? Is it, do you have to have them for a certain number of years?
If you're drafting a player in the first round, you're expecting that player to come in and be a starter and be a major contributor. And hopefully he's a red or blue player. That's a hit in the first round. Even in the second and thirds, you want to get your reds and, you know, what we call a marginal starter that can still win, you know, and through the second and third rounds. And then from the fourth and down, you're hoping to maybe hit on some reds, but filling in some back end needs on your roster.
Are there some positions that are easier to predict than others? Are there some where it's like the history tells us that there are a lot more whiffs than others, maybe outside of court or maybe including quarterback?
Yeah, no, there are, you know, we looked at it and from our, we really built up our analytics department. And what I thought was fascinating, and I did, including myself, is they tracked, because we graded every NFL player since like 2006, when I started with the Vikings. And so we track them and grade them every year and, you know, track their draft round and stuff, but then they would go and they would grade us. So I knew in the room that, you know, Scout A was hitting 78% of the receivers, but he was only 32% on offensive tackles. So we started working on making sure that we understood what our strengths were as graders. And then I would use those different combinations for the position, you know, and it's even bizarre. You wanted to be 10% or less on guys you said wouldn't make it, but end up making it. So, you know, I had one scout that he was, if he said a receiver was not going to make it, he was 92% right. And that usually came into the later rounds in the draft. So I'm sure in the heck was going to listen to him, because he was going to be pretty much sure that if I'm saying this guy is not going to make it, he's not going to make it. So there's a lot of different ways that we try to do it. And for me to understand that if I got Scout A, Scout B, Director C, what's the best combination at the position to listen to?
That's interesting. But that's primarily individuals have strengths and weaknesses in terms of scouting, as opposed to in general, the league has a very hard time at isolating who's going to hit at left tackle or something
right.
like that.
There's yeah, no, not- that's all. No, it's all individualized, you know, but to me, I always try to compare it to, you know, you have to know the strengths and weaknesses of your players. you have to know, I mean, the head coach should know the strengths and weaknesses of his coaching staff. This guy is really good teacher. This guy's a really good motivator. This guy's excellent game planner. You just have to know what everybody's strengths and weaknesses are, because then if you know that, hopefully it helps you. And I always looked at it from the friends that I had and the special ops in the military. They always want to try to minimize risk. And it's such a subjective topic and a subjective thing when you're selecting players, because you're trying to project what they're going to be. But with all of the potential, I would say, ancillary things that you can add in, you know, whether it's the testing, whether it's the arm length, you know, our analytics, they came up and were able to almost start cloning players now by all the measurables they got and their production. A player A coming out this year's draft was a clone to these four players that came out in 2006, 2012, 2013. So we've always tried to continue to evolve to try to minimize the risk on a selection as much as you could, but it's never going to be perfect.
Are we still using 40 times to factor in because of the chips and the pads and the fact that you have GPS data?
But the 40 times are, you know, still critical because of all the past data that we've used, but we can dice up that 40 time into different sections. So what's the most important? The first 10 yards for an offensive lineman, some skill positions. For example, the flying 20 was the most important. So we'd measure the first 20. And then if the flying 20, which was from the 20 to the finish, was faster or even, that was a critical part for some of the skill positions that we were looking at. So there's a lot of different ways. It's not just looking at the 40 time. It's looking at how, and this all evolved with analytics, how can we carve all this up? I said, guys, you have millions and millions of data points. I know what a good 40 is. I know, you know, what a good height and weight is, but how do we take it deeper to understand how we can use this for a potential competitive advantage? And so that's what we really try to hone in on and develop over the last 5 years. But it doesn't magically appear. It takes time to build, and then you layer on top of it each year.
That's the best argument that I've heard yet for the 40, just in terms of the consistency of a metric, so that you can compare and contrast from past years and that you're looking at the same thing.
Right.
I that makes sense to me. In terms of the personal,
was that the first thing that made sense so far today?
No. But with regard to the 40 conversation, because I've had a lot of conversations about the 40 in the last couple of years, you know, because of the GPS data and whether or not we still need it. And obviously it makes sense to me from a TV standpoint, that the NFL would still, you know, do it at the combine, because then people tune in and it's the favorite, but that makes sense to me.
Yeah. But that's value. Also what people, the fans and everybody watching, they don't understand the GPS. They understand what they're seeing because of the 40, I guess, if I could say, being institutionalized, they understand what that means.
Yeah. People tune in for the 40. People don't tune in for like a 3-cone drill or something like that.
Or his GPS score.
Yes, exactly. Yes. That's harder to track. One of the things that I have noticed this offseason that's come up that I think I'd be interested to get your thoughts on. There are always stories about players who feel like they were lied to or led astray. And I wonder what that is like for a general manager to balance. You are building personal relationships. Oftentimes you're recruiting people in free agency to come on your team. And then once they're on your team, they're yours, right? And you have relationships with them, but then you have to make very hard business decisions. And what you are charged with doing is moving the franchise forward and making sure that your team is the best that it can be. How do you balance that in terms of being honest when you feel like that person deserves it, but you also don't want to give something away from a business standpoint? How do you put all of that together?
Yeah, you have to treat it those, especially, and I've cut some significant vets, or we had to waive some significant vets just because of cap situation. And those are the most difficult conversations that you have. And I honestly knew what was coming the next morning when I had to call that player to my office, and I'd be up staring at the ceiling all night because I knew how difficult that was going to be, especially if a player has been there for and established himself. He's done everything right on the field. He's been a leader. He's been unbelievable in the community. He represents the organization to the nth degree in everything that he does. And you have to make a business decision. And those are the most difficult, but I think they respect it when you're at least sit there and talk with them openly and not be afraid to have those difficult conversations. And people are afraid to have difficult conversations, but I always felt that they were owed that because of what they did for this organization, what they did for this football team. And I made sure that I talked this, you know, to everybody as most I could at cutdowns, but any vet that was on our football team, I wanted to make sure I handled personally, and I handled it personally with his agent as well. I wasn't as good as my brother as a football player. He had he was born with a change of direction. I was born with a square jaw and a hair. So it's two different things, but that's a whole nother podcast we can get into. But I remember I was in and out of, I got cut twice. I got cut by the San Diego Chargers, and I got cut by the Detroit Lions after they drafted my brother. And I always like, I remember sitting there and how people handled me. And I always remember what I respected. And I didn't know back in 1987, 88, that I would be in the position I was in. But I always reflect back. And for some reason, I got cut. But from how I was handled when I got cut, I knew what was the first class way to do it and what I appreciated and what I thought was BS on the way they handled it.
It's such a perfect example of failure being character building, right? Yeah. Like what you take away from it can be productive.
No. And I, you know, we always looked at if we, whatever we did is, you know, in the organization, or if we missed on the draft pick, why the heck did we miss? So let's go back and learn from it. Identify what we did wrong, identify how we can improve. So the next time that scenario comes up, that we're able to make sure that we hopefully do not make that same mistake again, whether we missed on a character, on a measurement, on something we didn't see on the field that we were supposed to see. So we always, and I was a real big believer in what we called after action reviews, AARs, another military term, to go back and assess what you did good, what you did bad, so you can grow moving forward.
What are some of the things that you've noticed? And we've talked about a lot of the ways that what you see and what you know to be important when you are in it is sometimes different than what people value or assess on the outside. Are there any moves that have been made so far in this offseason, free agency, trades, whatever, that you think that people in your position value more than we do on the outside in terms of names that we're talking about, people that you see as being especially valuable or transformative for the team that brought them in?
Right. I think you have to remember is that the information we have on the inside, no one has on the outside, whether that's a medical, whether that's something we dug up through the security background. There are a lot more information that front offices have that will never become public. And that's why people will question, well, why in the hell did they do that? Well, or why didn't you take that guy? He's a great player. Well, there may be information that is not known to the public that helped us make that decision. I think the way the whole quarterback thing, because it seemed to be the talk of the town here over the last couple of weeks, where the one that probably got most criticized out there was when the Commanders traded for Carson Wentz. It didn't seem to get as big of applause as some of the other moves. But I also know Ron Rivera, I know Martin Mayhew and Marty Hernium, close friends with them. I know they had to do their due diligence before they made a move like that, and they must have felt strongly about it. Also, he's going back into the division. Now, Ron Rivera and them weren't there, I don't believe, when he was playing for the Philadelphia Eagles, but having them come back there, but they have to have some knowledge or something that may not be known on the outside that they felt very strongly that Carson Wentz can be the guy that can lead that franchise.
That the Colts didn't know?
Well, I don't know what the Colts situation was. Maybe they know something that it's all a cat and mouse game out there. And there's always speculation on the outside. And it's like, sometimes it's like reading a great novel, you know, on the narrative that's going around. But on the inside, there's so many other elements that aren't known. And maybe this team knows this and this team doesn't know that. It's like in a draft, maybe one team dug this up on a player and there's not a lot of hidden secrets anymore, but there are still some, and you try to use those to your competitive advantage.
So you don't view the Carson Wentz trade on the Commanders' part as a move of desperation?
I'll let you know that once we see what happens next year. I'm not good enough like the, you know, to put an A or B on a draft class 2 days
after 5 seconds later. speaking of next year, what is next for you?
I don't know. I'm still, enjoying time with the family.
Are you?
Yeah. Well, so far.
Tom Brady came back 2 months later.
Yeah, no, it's been great so far. We're getting ready to move. We bought a house in Florida. So I just been enjoying doing a lot of the media stuff. I enjoy getting prepared for it. I love teaching some of the knowledge, the things that I did well, the things that I didn't do well, and try to share those.
What do you think you did well? What do you think are your strengths?
I think my biggest strengths were I tried to be as organized and as detailed as possible, where we never left any stone unturned, that I made sure everybody understand that this, we're going to dive into this and we're going to dive into it as deep as we can. And it's everybody's responsibility to get that information that we need to make the best decisions. I think the biggest weakness probably that I've learned is that I never say no to anything. And sometimes that you get spread so thin.
Yes.
That you're doing this for this person, you're doing that for that person. And as when you're in charge of everything, you have to learn, which over the past 6 or 7 years, you have to learn to not micromanage, because you're the one to put those people in the place, let them do their jobs and let them be creative on their thinking, how they want to do it. I mean, when we started the analytics, I'm not going to sit there and tell you an algorithm. You know, I can't even barely spell it, let alone tell you what the hell it does.
Same.
You guys, this is what the result we want. You guys do it. You can stand on your head and spit wood nickels, all I care. But if that gives me the result that we're looking for, then more power to you. But give the, especially this newer generation come up, give them the ability and the space to be as creative of a thinker as possible. And you just kind of have to orchestrate everything, but let the people have the ability to go out there and be creative. And if they fail, that's great. I always thought, don't worry about it. That's one thing we know won't work, but this is what we learned from it and how we're going to do it the next time.
I know you interviewed for another GM job in Pittsburgh recently. Is that it? Do you want to dive back into all of that right away? Or are you
I'm not going to go down that road on what I am or what I am not going to do right now. Okay. I don't want to get divorced one way or another. I'll let you know. It changes on a daily basis.
I hear you. What options are out there? What do they look like? What are the pros? What are the cons? Then we'll make our decisions. Smart answer. Rick Spielman, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me on. It was fun.
All right, that'll do it for this episode. Hope you enjoyed it. If you did and you're up for it, I would really appreciate you taking the time to rate and review the pod on your platform. It helps bring new people to the show. Also, hope you will subscribe and join us again next week. We've got new episodes coming out every Thursday during the off season. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Sports Podcast Network. The producer is Andrew Emmer. Marissa Rivas is the acting director of sports podcasts for SiriusXM. And a special thanks to SiriusXM Senior Vice President of Sports Programming and Podcasting, Steve Cohen. Have a good one, guys.
SiriusXM Podcasts.